of Guru and Krishna, but externally it was not obvious how it would happen, or even if it would happen at all. When asked why he chose to go to New York instead of London, he said, "My God," this is the actual quote from Prabhupada, "my God brothers went to London and failed, so I thought I would go to New York and fail." Although he said this jokingly, he was well aware that he might fail, but since his guru asked him to spread Krishna consciousness in the West, it would have obviously been a much bigger failure not to try. This is my whole point. You see, Prabhupada's mood was, I was ordered to preach, I'll go to New York and fail in New York, but it's the order. So you see, he wasn't, even if Prabhupada failed, he would not have been a failure if he made his best effort to fulfill the order of his guru. That on the spiritual platform, that would be considered a complete success. Does that make sense? You're given an order by your spiritual master, and then you think, no, I'm not going to do it because I would fail if I try. Prabhupada didn't think that way. He thought, I may fail, that doesn't matter, but I've given the order, and the execution of the order, that is a success. It's a very powerful principle, because if you operate on this principle, you will see that you will naturally make greater efforts in your devotional service, so you'll have greater goals. No, it's not called the seventh. Brajadam's asking, is this article called Seven Steps to Success? No, it's called Failing to Succeed. I didn't know there was an article called Seven Steps to Success. Is there? Okay. Prabhupada's real success was that he got on the boat to America. He wasn't thinking, what if I don't succeed? What will everyone in India think of me? He was only thinking of the order of the guru. Have you ever thought about that? That you try to do something, you fail, and you think, what is everyone going to think of me if I fail? Have any of you thought like that? Kind of feeling, well, I'd be really embarrassed if I do this and I fail. Because so-and-so did this and they were successful, and I'm so much smarter than so-and-so, so much more talented than so-and-so. I'm so much older than so-and-so, and if I do it and fail, I'll be so embarrassed, better not try. Not good reasoning, is it? So Prabhupada was thinking, he wasn't thinking, what will other people think of me? He was thinking, this is the order of my guru, I should do it. Sometimes we are afraid to fail because our egos can't take it. We are afraid to fail because we don't want to admit to ourselves that we are not as competent as we think we are. Sometimes we just won't try to do something because it might disturb or destroy the image we have of ourselves if we fail. It's another bad reason not to try. And it's not the mood of a humble devotee. Yes, this article, I'm sorry, it's under newsletters. If you go to my website, tstrain.com, then you go to newsletters, then you'll find it. And it's number 7. And I will tell you what page we're on. We're on the second page. So the last point I was making, I don't know if any of you can relate to this, but sometimes we have a certain self-image and we may not want to try something because we might fail, or we think we might fail, and that might in some way destroy or diminish the image we have of ourselves, and that might be too difficult to take. Okay. This section is called Blessings for Real Success. So what is real success? Prabhupada was a surrendered servant of Krishna and worked tirelessly to establish the Hare Krishna movement. Even when there was no apparent success in his first year in America, he was never discouraged. Really important point. He was ordered to preach in the West, and he was doing his best to fulfill that order. Therefore, he was a success long before the external results came. Again, What was Prabhupada's real success? His success was that he got on the boat and left India. No sadhu, no Brajbasi, person who lived in Vrindavan, did that before. They wouldn't even leave Vrindavan. No one came, no Gaudiya Vaishnav came to the West to do this. So just getting on the boat and making the effort is a tremendous success. And if you see, if you read the history of what Prabhupada accomplished in the first year, you might look and think he wasn't successful. But he wasn't discouraged because he was able to execute the order of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta and spread Krishna consciousness, although it was not spreading that much in the beginning, but he was doing something. And therefore, even though there was very little result, he was successful. When the external results came, Prabhupada recognized that his success was due to the blessings of Guru and Krishna. Prabhupada said those blessings came simply because he tried to execute the order of the spiritual master. If Guru and Krishna help us, the impossible can become possible, even for us. We do our duty and leave the results to Krishna. This is so important. How important is this? So important. It's so important, I want to read that again. When those external results came, Prabhupada recognized that his success was due to the blessings of Guru and Krishna. Prabhupada said those blessings came simply because he tried to execute the order of his spiritual master. If Guru and Krishna help us, the impossible can become possible, even for you and me. We do our duty and leave the results to Krishna. So, why this is important is because there are many goals that we should all have in Krishna consciousness. And some of those goals, as I was saying before, they're beyond what we can achieve now. And what happens if those goals are quite lofty, then we think, why try? Because I can't achieve them. But if we are in the mood that, yes, it may be impossible, or and not even maybe, that it is impossible, but the impossible becomes possible by the mercy of Guru and Krishna. And it's not that I'm actually doing it. It's that Krishna is doing it through me when I show my sincerity and I make the effort, then Krishna can empower me to achieve far much greater results and achieve a far greater position in my own heart than I think is possible, or obviously than I could achieve on my own. So the point is that Krishna consciousness, it's not just us battling Maya. Sometimes I think we feel that way. Just me, you get up in the morning and then, okay, another day that I've got to deal with material energy. Have you ever felt that way? Just get up and go, oops, another day on the battleground. I've got to chant my rounds, I've got to follow certain principles, I've got to execute bhakti, I've got to keep my mind pure, my heart pure. It's another day in the battlefield. It's not you battling alone, it's you and Krishna. Krishna Surya Sam Maihai Andakar, where there is Krishna. Krishna, one side is light, and then there is Maya, she is darkness. Yaha Krishna Tan, Krishna Maya Adhikar, where there is Krishna, there is no darkness. So, we can take more bold steps if we realize, yes, I'm weak, but Krishna's strong, and actually the way we become empowered is to realize we're weak, because then we become more dependent on Krishna giving us that strength. Strength can come in the form of insight, realization, intelligence, energy, enthusiasm. All of these things ultimately are dependent on Krishna. And the nice thing about Krishna consciousness is that Krishna wants us to be Krishna conscious. So if we have the sincerity, if we put out the effort, automatically he can change the way everything in this world looks. It's so amazing. I don't know if you have this experience, but if you're ever in a state of consciousness where you really are praying to Krishna or desiring to understand Krishna consciousness more, desiring to advance in Krishna consciousness, Krishna can just change the way this whole world looks, and you see everything differently. You see everything in a way that pulls you up in Krishna consciousness, that brings you closer to Krishna. Or if you're in the opposite consciousness, then Krishna can make everything in this world appear as an object of your enjoyment with and impel you through the modes of nature to want to enjoy those things without limit. And I'm sure you've probably experienced both of those to some degree. So if we understand that, then we can pray to Krishna, Krishna, please reveal what this material energy is, reveal this external form so I can see it for what it is, and reveal the spirit, the bliss and the ecstasy of the spiritual energy, and enlighten me, give me knowledge by which I can approach you, by which I can see the path more clearly. And then, because Krishna wants us, he'll do that. He wants us to go back to Godhead. It's not like we're fighting against Krishna and Krishna's sitting there like this. He's going like this. Well, I don't know if I'm going to do that. You know, maybe I'll make you suffer some more until you get really, really serious. And then maybe I'll give you some intelligence. No, it's not like that. Sometimes it might feel that way, but it's not like that. Dadami buddhi yogam tam yena mam upayanti te. Krishna says, to those who are devoted and worship me with love, I give the intelligence. So my point is, the intelligence what? To come to me. My point is, Krishna wants to give that intelligence. So it's not like it's difficult. Maybe difficult to desire that, but if we desire that, then Krishna just so easily will give that, give us the inspiration. So if we understand that and we know that, then we become more enthused to achieve something greater. I can take this vow, I can make this commitment because I have Krishna's help. If I focus, and Krishna sees that focus, he reciprocates. Oh yes, this is what Mahatma wants. I'll help him achieve this. Wow, if Krishna helps me, then what happens? In the Bhagavatam, Srila Prabhupada writes, I will get to your questions in a moment. I want to finish this article. It's very short. Srila Prabhupada writes in the Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, about the process of hearing about Krishna, and there's a verse that says Krishna's in the heart, Suritsatam. He's the friend in the heart, and he cleanses, vidunoti. Vidunoti means to cleanse, Suritsatam, from within. The friend in the heart cleanses the dirt. Very nice. So in the purport, the purport to that verse, or a verse close to that verse, Prabhupada said, by this process of hearing about Krishna, the heart becomes cleansed. And Krishna becomes pleased, and Krishna helps the devotee from within. And then Prabhupada makes the point that if Krishna helps the devotee from within, the whole process becomes easy. So could you imagine if you could call Krishna on the telephone, say, Krishna, having some problems in my Krishna consciousness today, you think you could help me? And Krishna said, okay, what can I do for you? Then do you think Krishna consciousness would be easier if you could do that? Call him up and get some little advice, some inspiration, some help. Krishna, can you come over? Can you come over to my house and help me? I'm battling here with Maya, trying to chant my rounds nicely. I'm trying to think of you at work, trying to be a nice person, trying to treat people respectfully. I'm trying to be humble. Having a little trouble here. Can you help me? And if Krishna said, yes, okay, I'll help you, then what do you think will happen? Obviously, it's going to be pretty easy. It's almost like you don't have to do anything. He's going to do it for you. So it's not exactly like that, but it's similar to that. That you can call up Krishna through your intention, through your desire, through your prayer. Krishna, help me, please, please. And not only praying for help, but having the faith that he will do that, if that's what I want, if that's what I really want. Now, there's a dangerous side to that. What's the dangerous side? Who knows? The dangerous side of that. The dangerous side is, who can answer this question? What's the dangerous side is the opposite. That if you don't want Krishna, he'll help you forget him. So really, those are the two choices. is, yeah. Take it for granted, yes. That's true also. Could take it for granted that Krishna's there. He'll do all that, and we don't call him up. We don't ask for his help to love him. But the real danger is that if we don't do that, then Krishna might be saying, "Well, you don't want me. It looks like you want Maya. So I'll make arrangements for that. I'll help you with that side of your life." So Krishna will do that also. That, and if Krishna helps us fall into Maya, then how are we going to not fall into Maya? Not possible. So that's a interesting concept. So before I get to your question, let me read the rest. So the next section of this article is called Don't Fail to Succeed. No, excuse me. Don't fail to succeed. Don't fail to succeed. What does that mean? Pay attention. You'll learn something wonderful right now. We shouldn't be afraid to fail. We should not be afraid to fail. A lot of people are afraid to fail. Rather, we should fail soon and often. Wow. Why would I say that? Okay, I'm instructing all of you tonight to go out and fail, and fail a lot, and don't procrastinate, start failing right away. Just go out and start failing, and fail a lot. And you're all thinking, Mahatma ate too much prasadam tonight, and he's gone mad, and he's telling us all to go out and fail. So why would he say that? Well, there's a reason to my madness. Those who are afraid to fail. Okay, let's go back. We shouldn't be afraid to fail. Rather, we should fail soon and often, because this is how we learn. Those who are afraid to fail rarely do anything great. Did you hear that? Those who are afraid to fail rarely do anything great, because you're never going to try to do anything great, because obviously you're going to fail, so why try, right? Aren't you glad you weren't afraid to fail when you first attempted to walk? As long as we learn by our so-called failures, those failures become the pillars of our success. Sometimes the only way we're going to learn is to fail, and that's why it's recommended to fail often, because every time you fail, you learn. Just like Thomas Edison, when he failed, he learned what didn't work. What did he do? 1,000 experiments before he got the light bulb to work. And every time he failed, he said, "Now I know that doesn't work, and that doesn't work, and that doesn't work." So he took it in a positive way. You can always learn something by failure. Sometimes you actually have to fail to learn something. It's the only way. Okay, so when you think you have failed, just ask yourself, what can I learn from this? And then you can give your failure a new name. You can call it a learning experience. Just like sometimes a devotee will take initiation and he will promise to follow four regular principles and chant 16 rounds. And at some point in his or her life, he or she may not keep those vows. And then they feel like a total failure. But I would advise such persons to learn something. How is it that you ended up breaking one of the principles? Or how is it that you ended up not keeping your vow to chant a certain number of rounds? How did you get sidetracked? How did you become weak? Trace back your steps. And then I would ask, what can you learn from this so that it won't happen again? Or what can you learn from this so that you can become stronger? And it can have a very positive effect on you when you take it that way. Now you've just fallen, or you've set a goal, you made a commitment, and you haven't achieved the goal, or you've broken the commitment, and you're discouraged or depressed. But if you take it in a positive way, then you can say, okay, what can I learn so the next time I won't fail? Or what can I learn so the next time I'll achieve greater success. Then it becomes a very positive thing. Yes, I've learned so much from this. I'm never going to do that again, or I'm going to try this instead of that. So it becomes very, very positive. And then you can come out of that experience of so-called failure with a renewed kind of determination and enthusiasm. Kind of turn the whole thing around. Say, no, this really turned out to be something positive. Now, I'm not saying all of you who have taken vows of initiation should go out tomorrow and fall down so you can learn something. I don't think you'd learn anything by premeditated fall down. But if you have fallen or you do fall, then they say you're not a failure if you fall down. You're a failure if you, what? Stay down. Right? Just like, let's say you fall in the ocean. As long as you can dog paddle, keep your head above the water, you're okay. There's hope. But if you give up and you sink, you stop dog paddling and keeping your head above water, then you're a failure. So it's not a fall down does not mean you're a failure. You're only a failure if you fall and you stay down. That's the point. So that, you know, obviously it's hard sometimes if we're falling to be determined, but the point is if we take those experiences and learn from them, then they can be very positive experiences and very motivating. Okay. Since our effort to serve Krishna is our success, and since the reality is that we often need to fail to improve, we can't lose by making the effort. But if we fail to fail, then we fail to succeed. If we fail to fail, then we fail to succeed. In other words, if we become so cautious that we won't do anything, if there's any chance of failing, then we fail to succeed, because it's only by taking that chance that ultimately we will succeed. As I said, when Prabhupada started his movement, you could say in the beginning he was failing. It seemed, in a sense, not a whole lot was going on. But he was never a failure, ever. Because he had the order of his guru in his heart. And that was his success, to make that effort. You know, when Prabhupada came, he thought, well, it's possible no one will hear my message, so I'll stay for a short time. I'll make the effort and thereby fulfill the order of my guru, and then I'll go back to India. And so he was seeing success in that way. If no one takes to it, it's still a success because he did his dharma, he did his duty. So, I'm going to give you an exercise. Would you like an exercise to do this week? Well, I'll give you the option. I'm going to give you the exercise and see if you'd like to do this. Try to do something for Krishna you have been reluctant to do because you're afraid you might fail. Try to do something this week that you haven't yet done because you're afraid if you do it, you might fail. Now, here's the key. Don't worry about succeeding. Okay. Try to do something that you've been afraid of doing, perhaps. Do it. Not without worrying whether you're going to succeed or fail. Just do it to please Krishna and please your spiritual master. Then write your realizations and apply what you learned to other activities you haven't yet done because of the fear you may fail. So once you do this, the thing that you've been afraid to do, just make the effort to do it and write some realization. And those realizations may propel you into other areas of your life where you feel you might fail. Okay, now I'm going to see if you have any questions. Okay. Can there be success without Guru or Krishna? Everything, either materially, for material success or spiritual success, is dependent on Krishna. In the Bhagavad Gita, there's a nice verse. Krishna says that people who worship the demigods, he said, they're actually worshiping me, but they're doing it in the wrong way. He said, actually, because all the worship of the demigods is really meant for me. And then he says, those who want to worship the demigods, I make their faith strong. So in the ultimate analysis, nothing can be done without Krishna unless Krishna sanctions, unless Krishna gives determination. Krishna gives us perseverance. Krishna gives us the energy and the intelligence to execute an activity. How can we be successful? Now, you ask, is it possible without Guru and Krishna? When you bring it to the spiritual realm, then yes, it is all dependent on the mercy of Guru. That's what how we began this article, where Prabhupada was saying, whatever success he has, it's the mercy of Guru and Krishna. So, this is what my friend Madan Mohan calls passing the hot potato. Hot potato, and you play with hot potatoes. I forget how the game goes, but you throw the potato. Is that it? It's a hot potato, and you throw it, and each person throws it. Okay. Is that it? Hot potato? Is there a song that goes with that? Hot potato. Anyway, one potato, two potato, three potato, more. It's been a long time, folks, since I played hot potato. But anyway, so he was saying that often if we do something wonderful, seemingly wonderful in Krishna consciousness, people will praise us. And he said, it's a hot potato. The hot potato is in your hand. And you throw the hot potato up to who? To your guru. Because whatever you do is the mercy of your guru or the mercy of other Vaishnavas or the mercy of Krishna. So you throw the hot potato up to them. It's not yours. So this is exactly what Prabhupada did. He said, I don't think I've done anything great, but if you want to say I've done anything great, it's only because I executed the order of my guru, and it's all his mercy. So that's the attitude of a devotee. And when you're in that attitude, you can have a much bigger vision about what is possible, because now you don't feel it's entirely relying on you, but it's a group effort between Guru, Krishna, and you. And it is said, Mukam Karoti Bhachalam. A dumb man who cannot speak, can recite, by the mercy of the Guru, he can recite poetry. Mukam what did I just say? I already forgot. Kam Kavita Kare? That's another verse. Pangu Giri Lange, Mukam. He can speak poetry, he can climb mountains if he's lame, and Deke Taragane, he can see if he's Anda, Deke Taragane, if he's Anda, blind, he can see stars, groups of stars in the sky, by the mercy of Guru. Karoti vachalam pangu langayate girim. Pangu means lame. And giri means mountain. He can langate, climb mountains. So this is the idea in Krishna consciousness. To become the instrument that Krishna can work through you, if you make your desires one with Krishna, then he can use you. It's just like electricity is going through you, spiritual electricity. Therefore, it said, Krishna Shakti Vina Nahi Tara Pavartana. One cannot spread Krishna consciousness unless that electrical current of Krishna goes through them. And if that electrical current goes through you, then you will find that you can do things you didn't even think you could do. And while you're doing them, you'll just be watching yourself and saying, I can't believe I'm doing this. I've experienced that many times. I can't believe I'm saying this. I don't know who's saying it, but it's not me. Someone is speaking through me, or someone is writing through me. Srila Prabhupada said, I don't write my books. Krishna speaks through me. Krishna's dictating these to me. So you can have that experience when you put yourself on the line. So because we're talking about commitment and vows, the point is that we can become empowered to do greater things or make greater commitments than we may think we are capable of. So, are there any other questions? There is no success, Street Straw says, there is no success like failure. I like that one. there is no success like failure. Let's write a song. Well, that is Bob Dylan. And failure is no success. And failure is no success at all. In our books, it's a big success. When Bob Dylan becomes a devotee, then he'll have to change the lyrics to that song. And failure is all success. And then, throw the hot potato. Yes, the Prabhupada song when he came to America. Wonderful song. Krishna, if you like, you can make my speaking suitable. My dear Lord Krishna, somehow you brought me here to this horrible place. I don't know why you brought me here. I don't know what I can do. I don't know if they can understand my message. If you like, you can make my speaking suitable. You're sitting in their heart. If you like, you can make them or help them understand my message. Just make me dance like a puppet on a string. What a nice prayer. So you can see when a devotee is in that mood, so many things become possible. And then otherwise we just will calculate based on our own capabilities, which can be, which may be quite limited. Okay. Pongulangayite girim. The kripa tamaham vandesi guru dinatarinam. Dinatarinam means that by the mercy of the guru I can dinatarinam, cross over the ocean. And there, the ocean of material existence. There's so many verses that says, verses that say, by remembering Lord Chaitanya, difficult things become easy, and by forgetting him, easy things become difficult. And similar verses like that, of verses of empowerment. So, you know, you can test Krishna. Say, okay, Krishna, you say, ananyas chintayanto mam ye jana pariyupasate, you say that you preserve what I have and carry what I lack. Okay, I'm going to test that. You know that story? I think it was Jayadeva Goswami. He read that verse. And in that verse, Krishna says, I personally, personally come and provide for you. I preserve what you have and I carry what you lack. And he didn't believe that. He crossed it out. That verse, across the line, to Krishna does not personally come to give what I lack. And then after he did that, he went out of his house to take bath, and two young boys came over, and they had some fruits and vegetables, because he had no food in the house, or very little food. And these boys said, your husband told us to bring these, but he was very unkind, and he whipped us in the back. And so they had line on their back. I don't know if both Krishna and Balaram had lines on their back. They had this line on their back, and the lady said, oh, my husband, he'd never do that. He's a nice man. I said, yeah, he did that. He told us to come here. So they left before he came home. And his wife said, you know, those boys brought the vegetables and fruit, but why did you hit them in the back? And he said, what are you talking about? There were no boys. I didn't tell any boys to come and bring fruits and vegetables and grains and spices like they did, and I didn't hit any boys. What are you talking about? She said, oh, these boys brought this, and there was a line scratched on their back. They said, you did that. And then he understood when he did that it was Krishna who came, because Krishna actually carries what we lack, preserves what we have, and he doubted that he would carry what we lack personally, that there were. The verse says Krishna personally does it, and he thought, no, Krishna might do it through some agent, but not personally. So that's the story. So, you know, we're working with a very powerful person, and we can have a lot of confidence to do greater things, because it's not us, it's if Krishna works through us. It's amazing. It's like an intoxicant, almost like something comes over you, and it's not you. So, another verse. Sri Guru Dinatarinam Paramananda Madhavam. That's another verse. So, why are we Vaishnavas? You don't have to be a Vaishnava. We're devotees. Vaishnava means devotee. We're all devotees, as Prabhupada said. We're all devotees. Some admit it and some don't. Now he once said, they said, how many disciples do you have? He said, unlimited. Everyone is my disciple. Some admit it and some don't. So in the same way, everyone's devotee of Krishna. We're all Vaishnavas. We just admit it and others don't. We are Vaishnavas. We are always Vaishnavas. Not why are we? We are because we admit we are, where others don't admit it. Okay, Rasa Rasika, when we act for the Lord, this is based on our desire to please or serve Him. To what degree does our success or failure rely on the strength of our desire, and to what degree Krishna's sanction? You know, it's a complex issue because there may be more things involved in that. And we're all going to get various degrees of success according to so many factors. You know, just like some people are better at doing things, and If your desire, I would say we can only answer that question in relative to one individual. The stronger your desire and the greater you manifest that desire externally through the effort and determination, then the greater degree of success. Now, sometimes Krishna may have his own reason not to give you success. Like sometimes we find that if a devotee becomes successful, maybe the devotee would become proud. So Krishna thinks, I'm not going to allow that devotee to be successful because he's going to become proud. That won't be good. So the devotee's trying so hard, and Krishna's saying, no, not till you become humble. Not till you just fall on your knees and beg in a humble way while I allow you to be successful. Or Krishna may not allow a devotee to be too successful too quickly because perhaps the devotee cannot handle it, even though the devotee is desiring it so strongly. Maybe he can't handle it spiritually, maybe he can't handle it materially. So, but still, or maybe Krishna won't give success because he wants you to try harder. So you're trying so hard and you're not getting the success that you want. And Krishna's just holding you back because he wants you to try harder, a little more, make a greater effort. And you know what they say? They say most people give up right before they're about to succeed. I think I even have a quote. What is it? Here, I'll read this quote. This is a great quote. So everyone pay attention. You'll like this. Do not quit. Hundreds of times I've watched people throw in the towel at the 1 yard line while someone else comes along and makes a fortune by just going that extra yard. I'm looking for this other quote. Really nice quote. It's a couple nice quotes. When you get down to the root of the meaning of the word succeed, you find that it simply means to follow through. And we just keep working, determination. Most of the important things in the world have been accomplished by people who have kept on trying when there seemed to be no hope at all. What a wonderful quote, Dale Carnegie. Most of the important things in the world have been accomplished by people who have kept on trying when there seemed to be no hope at all. Nice, isn't it? So this other quote I don't have, but I remember reading, said that most people give up right before they're about to achieve success. It's like that. You know, you've tried so hard and you're working and it's not happening and you just give up. That's actually when it's going to happen. Would you just feel like I can't do this anymore? That's when you're going to succeed. Okay. So Krishna may do that to you also. He may just say, well, I want you to work harder, so I'm not going to give you this success. Okay. You know what Srila Prabhupada said? You don't know, because you don't know what I'm thinking, but I'll tell you what he said about this. He said, in the beginning, Krishna took everything away from me, and he wanted to see what I was going to do. And then, later on, he gave me everything, and he wanted to see what I would do. Nice, isn't it? So while Krishna's taking everything away, you might think, oh, I'm a total failure. Why is Krishna taking everything away? What's wrong with me? Just maybe that Krishna wants to see what you're going to do. If you're going to give up, if you're going to become depressed, just throw in the towel. Or if you're going to just keep trying another strategy, another way, keep persevering. So Krishna wants to see what we do on both sides, when he takes it away and when he gives it. So I would say, in answer to your question, don't give up. You know the story about Winston Churchill? I think they flew him over to Harvard to give an address, you know, one of the big schools here, Yale or Harvard or one other Ivy League colleges. They flew him over to give a lecture to the graduating class. You know, so lecture is going to, you know, lecture to the graduating class, you know, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, half hour. That's what they're expecting. So he gets up there and he says, never give up. Never give up. Never give up. And he walks off the stage or the podium. That was his lecture. That was the best advice he could give from all his experience in this world. That's such good advice, isn't it? So, I would say, no matter what we go through, no matter how difficult things are, old Bach the Winston can be our guiding light. Never give up, never give up, never give up. I mean, Krishna consciousness is too valuable to ever give up on it, isn't it? Okay. So, my question is on the top line. Did I answer your question, or we go back up there? Did I miss your question? Why are we Vaishnavas? No. Oh. What is the difference between Krishna and Vishnu? Why is Vishnu called Hari Govinda? Krishna's original form and Vishnu is an expansion. And Krishna's form is found in Vrindavan with Radha. It's called Swayam Bhagavan. That's his original feature. So, whenever you see a picture of Krishna with Radha, Krishna with the cowherd boys, that's his original form. That's the most intimate form, in which you exchange with him in the most intimate way. Okay, so where are we here? I've been listening to Bhagavad Gita. God says he lives in every heart. How does the evil come to this person when God resides in him? Because, very good question, because Krishna gives every one of us a choice. We were discussing this today in class. Prabhupada said, you have light and you have darkness. So Krishna's light and the material world, or Maya, is darkness. And he said, just like, you know, let's say there's light in the house. Like here in Alachua, it's dark outside now. So in here, it's light. When we go outside, there's darkness. So we can either go out in the darkness or we can come back and stay in the light. So Prabhupada said, so there's always Krishna and Maya. And it's your choice which way you want to go. So however you choose Krishna from within your heart, then he'll give you the intelligence how to achieve whatever your desire is. That's why Krishna's there. He's there to fulfill your desire. Srila Prabhupada said a couple of things further about this. He said that we can't properly function unless Krishna's within our heart, because Krishna gives us intelligence how to function in this world. But he said the real reason Krishna's in our heart is to guide us back to him. But if we don't want to go back to him, then he'll guide us away from him, or he'll guide us to some other form of religion, perhaps a lesser form or a false form. He'll just guide, he's there to guide us any way we want to go to. It's said that Krishna's been fulfilling our desires since time immemorial. So watch out what you desire, because Krishna's there to fulfill it. He'll give you all kinds of inspiration and intelligence how to do that. So, Okay, Krishna doesn't allow his devotee to be too successful until the devotee is humble. You know, when you're humble and you can take the success. When Prabhupada was asked something like, you know, why doesn't Krishna give us the whole world? And Prabhupada said, he can give you the whole world, but what will you do with it? He said, you'll simply sleep. Now, could you imagine? Could you imagine if Krishna gives us the whole world? What would you, you know, okay, all right. All right, devotees, here it is. The whole world is yours. They go, oh, great. I go to sleep now. Mission accomplished. There's no more, you know, no. So, Krishna can give you the whole world when you know how to use it. Okay. Okay, Winston Churchill. Yes. Never give up, never give up. All right, well, has a question. Why is Vishnu also called as the same names of Krishna? There are different names of Krishna, and they describe Krishna in his activities or in his qualities. So all those names describe different aspects of Krishna, and different devotees worship Krishna in those different forms. Sometimes when you say Vishnu or Krishna, if you're a devotee of Krishna, you're a Krishna Bhakti, when you say Vishnu, to you it means Krishna. Because Krishna is your worshipful Lord. So every name of Krishna, it's like, let's say your father's a judge. So you call your father daddy, but they call him, in the court, he's called your honor. So let's say you're in the public, so you may have to refer to your father as the judge or his honor or your honor. But when you say the judge, your honor, etc., in your mind you're just thinking daddy. So when we say Vishnu, as Krishna devotees, when they say Vishnu, they're thinking of Krishna. That's who they mean. Yes, so the real thing is that we want to become qualified for Krishna to use us. That's a very nice meditation, a very nice way to end this evening's class. Let's become qualified in such a way that Krishna can use us. Right? Is that a good meditation? So Krishna, you know, Krishna, I want you to use me. I want to be of some use in your service. I want to be of some use to helping other people. I want to act in a way that pleases you. So please, please use me. Please, I will try my best to qualify myself so you can use me. So, it is now time to end. It's actually past time to end. Does anyone have any questions? Oh yes, I promised to tell that story last week about Harish Chandra. You remember that story? Totally incredible story, but it's late now, so I'm only going to tell you a little more. Keep you in suspense. So, if you don't remember the story, what happened was Vasishtha and Vishwamitra were having a conversation, and Vasishtha said, there are truthful people in this world, and Vasishtha said, nobody's completely truthful and honest. And so they did an experiment, and Vasishtha said, I'll show you. And so through some kind of trickery, Vishwamitra was able to take away Harish Chandra's kingdom. And Harish Chandra had owed him some money, and so when he took away his kingdom, he said, you have to pay me the money you owe me. And he said, well, it's going to take some time because I don't have anything since you have my kingdom. And he sent him away. And then he said, you know, you should pay me in a certain period of time. And that he went to get the money from him, and he hadn't fully paid him. And Vishwamitra said, you know, if you want, you don't have to keep your word, I don't mind. He said, no, I've given my word. And what he had to do is sell his wife and son to get money to pay. But that was only half of what he owed. So then he sold himself. And they both became slaves of other people. And Harishchandra became slave of in a crematorium. And the man who ran the crematorium was like this ugly monster type person. And Harishchandra he worked there for a year or two, and he started looking like this man, you know, just ugly and dark and deformed. And this was like the last job in the universe that he wanted. It was just horrible working in the crematorium. And then one lady came with her dead son, and she had no money to pay. And he said, I can't do this because I have to pay my master and I have to pay the king. He said, why don't you go get some money? And then the man saw the little gold locket that the woman had and said, why don't you go sell that gold locket? You'll get some money. At least you can pay for half of this. And the woman was so embarrassed. She said, no man has ever seen that before but my husband. At that point, Harishchandra realized that woman who came with this dead boy, and this woman was like, this is dirty and skinny and ugly and destitute, nothing. He realized that was his wife. And he just like broke down. His wife was in that condition with a dead son. And he said, why don't you go sell that? So she went to sell it, and what happened is this man saw her and he became sorry for her, and he gave her a bag and it was full of jewels. Then right after that happened, the police came and they took her in because that man was a thief and they thought she was a thief. Said, you stole the jewels from that boy, that little boy, and you killed him. Which is what the robber did. She said, no, that's not what happened. And she explained the story. I said, we don't believe you. And she was sentenced to be executed. And guess who she was sentenced to be executed by? Harishchandra had to execute her. He had to obey the orders of his superiors. So he took up the axe and he put the axe over his head to kill her. And right at that point, Vishwamitra stopped him and said, I've been proven wrong. This was all an illusion that I created. None of this actually happened. And I saw that you kept your word through all of this. And I've been proven wrong. There is a man who is truthful. So the moral of that story was Harishchandra made a commitment to pay back Vishwamitra, and he never reneged on that commitment despite all the suffering he had to undergo. You like that story? Interesting, isn't it? How loyal he was to his word. And on that, we will end tonight and we will see you next week. And do something this week that you have been afraid to do and just make the effort. Go that extra mile for Krishna. Hare Krishna. Thank you. Is that an amazing story? You want to read it? Read the details of it. You're like, oh, nuts. Do you want me to read the last part?
I remember hearing it, actually.
One night, a ragged, destitute woman brought to the burning ground her own arms, in her arms, the body of her son. He was a small boy. He had died of a snake bite. She had brought with her a bundle of sticks with the funeral pyre. Harishchandra demanded for the prescribed fees for the cremation. She pleaded with him. She was destitute and could not pay. Harishchandra refused to prepare for the cremation. He said that he could attempt his own share. He could exempt his own share, but she had to collect at least the king's and the master's share. He saw a little jewel of gold hanging from her neck, mostly hidden by her ragged clothes, and suggested that this be sold. On hearing this, the woman started crying, "Oh gods, what sins have I committed? The sacred symbol of my marriage, which was till now visible only to my husband, should be seen by this cremated cemetery assistant." Harshchandra was startled. He peered into the face through the enveloping darkness and asked,
"So it could only be seen by him? Is that how
I'm hearing, oh gods, what sins have I committed that the sacred symbol of my marriage, which till now was visible only to my husband, should be seen by the cemetery assistant?"
Does that mean there's like some special kind of medallion only the husband can see because of?
I think it was just always covered and it was visible. Harshchandra was startled. He peered into the face through the enveloping darkness and asked, "Who was your husband?" She replied, sobbing, "My husband was once a king. A cruel creditor had forced him to sell her and their son in the market of Varanasi." Harshchandra saw what he was up to and fell on the dead body crying, "Oh, Rohita, darling son, my son, I am your father here. Come to me, dear child. My God, what snake was it? What were you doing? How did it happen? Oh, God, I can't bear this anymore." This one was once a king. It was indeed Chandramati, Harshchandra's wife, who had brought her son to the burning ground at the dead of night. They recognized each other and wept together, caressing the lifeless corpse of their son lying on their laps. They resolved not to outlive their child. They wanted to get into the pyre and put an end to their lives. But then the problem of the cremation of the boy had to be resolved. Harshchandra had to collect his fees. He told Chandramati, "Get back to her master and beg of him the money needed." Chandramati had no option. She had to leave for the cemetery. As she was returning home, groping through the darkness, a man with a small bundle in his hand accosted her. "Who are you? Why are you weeping? Why are you here?" Chandramati related the story and asked the man to show the way to the master's house. The man, hearing the story, said, "You don't have to go all the way. Take this bundle. It has some jewels. You can use these jewels to pay for the cremation." He thrust the bundle into her hands and ran into the woods. She was left alone in utter fright. She heard the oncoming sounds of horses. Beams of penetrating light were seen. They were the police of the city on horseback in pursuit of the thief who had burglared into a house and strangled a sleeping child and had stolen the jewels. The police saw the woman with the bundle in her hands and thought she was the thief. She was taken prisoner, taken to the magistrate. How heartless can you be to steal a child's jewels?" shouted the magistrate. She narrated the story and explained how the bundle had come to her hand. The magistrate did not believe her. "You are a murderer and a thief. Don't add another attribute of being a liar." The magistrate condemned her to death before sunrise. The next morning, she was led away to the executioner. Harshchandra was on vigil that night near the body of the son, awaiting the arrival of his wife with the fee. She was being led in chains to the block for being executed as a criminal. Harshchandra saw this and could scarcely believe his eyes. He ran towards the place of execution. He was stopped on the way by a boy who brought the master's message. Pravira wanted Harshchandra to at once fetch the axe and execute the criminal who was being led to the block. Harshchandra was reeling under the impact of horror upon horror being heaped on him. He was rendered speechless momentarily. The execution had to go on. The orders of the master keeper of the cemetery were unequivocal and very clear. Harshchandra brought the axe and proceeded to the place of execution. The guards read out the orders to the magistrate. It was not for Harshchandra to question the orders nor produce counter evidence to prove the victim's innocence. It was only the slave of his master whose orders had to be carried out. Chandramati looked at Harshchandra with a stony, cold stare. Her agony was too deep for tears. As though by mutual consent, husband and wife refused to recognize each other. They didn't say a word in the presence of the guards. They had to go through the final stages of their tragic lives and get on with it and meet on the other side of death. Harshchandra took the axe in both hands, closed his eyes, and in speechless torment of prayer, and started lifting the axe up over his head. And as he was bringing down the axe, his hands were seized from behind by Vishwamitra, who had now appeared on the scene. Gods gathered around in heaven, watching the ordeals of the king. Vishwamitra acknowledged his defeat to Vaishishta and announced, "O Harshchandra, you are now alive. Yours is now alive. You and your wife have merited a place in heaven by your adherence unswervingly to virtue in the most trying circumstances. All your troubles so far are merely illusion created by me. Indra, the king of the gods, explained to Harshchandra how his virtue was being put to test. He welcomed the couple to heaven and asked him to install the sun on the throne of Kosala.
So they put their sun on the throne and
the heavenly planets. Hare.